Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. We're starting part four. And remember, I said last week that instead of this series being three parts, it's going to be open-ended, and that the part three that I had originally developed some time ago, I'm pushing back, and I don't know exactly when that part will come on air. Today's part four is a new part, and so let's get right to it. To start with, if you have been here before and you heard the intro provided by Deborah, there's a part there when she says the new corporate state elite and their Machiavellian agenda to destroy public education. That's where we are now. Keep in mind, I'm still talking about neoliberalism and that the war that we are currently in is being driven by neoliberalism and the principles contained therein. That segment, what says the corporate state elite Machiavellian agenda. I'm using the word Machiavellian as an adjective. The operative word there is agenda, but I'm giving you a hint of how I characterize that agenda when I say Machiavellian. I think it's very, very fair to assume that most people, particularly most adults, when you say Machiavellian, we have a shared vision, understanding, concept of what you're talking about or what you're implying. Machiavellian is not a compliment. When someone says very Machiavellian of you, that's not a compliment. That's derogatory. And I selected Machiavellian agenda, with Machiavellian being the adjective, for that expressed reason, so that basically there was no need to explain it per se, although it is very, very, a very apt description of the agenda. Let me tell you how I arrived at this. I have said in the past that I left education, came back to teaching, then I left again, and the last time I left, I started in a whole new different direction. I wanted to become a master storyteller. I wanted to become a filmmaker, and I studied all of that, and I made a film and wrote scripts, the whole nine yards. I left the U.S. I went to Paris. I lived in Paris on two different occasions. It's when I came back from Paris the last time that I noticed the charter schools in my neighborhood. They're like fleas. They're everywhere. And I had no idea what was going on. And I started to look into it. And as I started to look into it, I started to realize that there was something happening, not only just here in Los Angeles, but across the state, across the country. And this thing was much bigger than I had ever thought up to that point. And as I began to really understand what was happening across this country, and I say globally too, because it is a global phenomenon, I became angry. Pissed is a better word. And I wanted to do something. And what I decided to do was to write a screenplay that laid out the evil that I was looking at. And in that screenplay, at the very beginning, one of the first things that I tried to make very, very clear was a situation where a school was on the list to be closed. This was a particularly special school in that the principal of that school, a woman, had been best teacher of the year for her district, best teacher in the state. She was best teacher in the nation, awarded and recognized in the White House. She was a best principal. She had everything that, quote, you were supposed to be as an educator. But yet her school was put on this list. So she and the teachers at her school went down to the Board of Education. They went to the council people. They did all those things to try and get their school removed from the list. Under the theory that she had what Bush had talked about every opportunity he could, capital. He had political capital. She thought she had some political capital, education capital, and she could save her school. Well, it was apparent that that capital wasn't going to help her, and she wasn't going to be able to help her school. Enter another character who's older, more experienced, and he is asked to come there to help out as a favor to a person he can never say no to. And when he gets there to the first meeting where the principal and the community and the teachers are there strategizing, going over what they've done and what they plan to do, this stranger walks in, and the first thing he says is, that has about a snowball's chance in hell of surviving. Everyone turns around and they look at him. Now, this is a screenplay that I'm writing, okay, so not reality. Everyone turns and look at him, and he goes on to say that their school, closing their school was a done deal. It was a done deal a year ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, that this was part of a plan and that there was nothing they were going to really be able to do about it because the plan / agenda had been set and it was now just time to execute it. When I was writing that section, first thing, many things was coming across my mind at the time. One was when the principal and her staff and the community was trying to figure out what to do and what they have done wasn't successful. I kept saying, that's because they don't see, they don't know, they're unaware of the big picture, that this is more than just their school. But they don't know. And really, they have no reason to know, especially in the beginning of this process, the early 2000s, when the Race to the Top was signed into law, and those provisions tucked in the law that I call the Trojan Horse Law that made it possible to close schools, turn a school around, hand a school over to a private management company, convert the school to a charter school. Those provisions were put there for a reason. It was the, in my view, it was the reason for the bill. The real reason for the bill was to set in place a mechanism through which public schools could be destroyed and privatized education could be erected in its place. So, in thinking about this particular principle, that she had no way of knowing the big picture, and it would take someone to come into this story who could see the big picture and who could explain to them what has happened to them, what will happen to them, and not just them, to hundreds, if not thousands, of schools across the country. And it was during that process of bringing that new character in, I said, how does he know? How does he know this big picture sort of thing? Well, of course, I made him a person who had gone through it before several times and had gotten his ass kicked because he was unable to save any of the schools that he was trying to save, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I thought, wait a minute, why did he get his ass kicked? And when I'm learning this as I'm going along here. So then I looked and I said, let's look at what's been happening. And as I started to look at it, I saw a marvelous, you have to admire the depth and breadth of the plan. It was meticulous. And the first thing I thought, Karl Rove. You guys know that name? Karl Rove. Last name R-O-V-E. For those of you who don't, Karl Rove was the person, like the person behind the throne. He took a George Bush, who was probably at the time an executive with the Texas Rangers baseball organization, and made him governor of Texas, 2 terms. He then positioned him and got him elected as president of the United States. And for 6 years or so while in the presidency, he was the, I want to say, power behind the throne. I'll give you an example if you don't know what I'm talking about. Karl Rove is referred to by Washington insiders, political pontiffs, you name it, as, and even Bush called him the brain, golden boy, all kinds of names to depict this man's brilliance. But then there was one name in one book. I bought a couple books on the guy, and I read and I studied and what have you back in the early 2000s. But it was one book that really caught my eye when they called him basically modern-day Machiavellian, that he was the prototypical protocol of the Machiavellian prince that Machiavelli wrote about. Give an example. People say that whatever he is going to do, say on Monday, tomorrow, a week from that Monday, 2 weeks, a month, a year, 10 years from that Monday, he will be doing exactly what he planned to do on that first Monday 10 years ago. He is that methodical. He is that brilliant. He, when he develops a plan, he takes in every possible scenario in terms of how to win and every scenario in terms of how you could lose. And then he adjusts his plans accordingly. He's capable of being very nimble. Something pops up that he wasn't foreseeing. He scopes it out, analyzes it, and makes adjustments on the fly. The man is supposed to be just super brilliant. He's the Machiavellian of his generation. And my first thought was, when I was writing this story, and then coming to realize what was really happening, the big picture, the very first thing I said to myself is, Karl Rove's fingerprints, handprints, footprints, ass print is all over this. This agenda is so well thought out, planned, and executed that only Karl Rove could do that. Well, I'm sure he didn't do it. I think he was very much involved, of course, with No Child Left Behind, because that happened very early in Bush's first term in office. And it came out of the experience in Texas. And so I would say that. But the actual putting together the plan that we are all now being warred upon under, I don't say that he did it, but whoever did it, single individual, one individual, a group, is fantastic. Now, that's how I got to calling this the Machiavellian agenda and the connotation that I wanted everyone to hone in on. Machiavellian himself, Italian, in the 1500s, born of probably middle class kind, what was, you know, we considered middle class family, got whatever education that was available at the time, but most people didn't get education. And here's something that I wanted to remember to tell you. The education that he got, it was in the humanities. I find it to be ironic. He studied the humanities, the exact thing that today's neoliberal want to get rid of is your history, your political science, or civics classes, your music, your arts, and et cetera, and social sciences, if you teach those in your high school, and et cetera. It was that, I'll call it classical education for the period, that helped him to get some of the positions that he got working in the various governmental offices that he was part of. And it was that experiences in those various offices that he was able to see firsthand politics, war, and begin to formulate some kind of picture for himself and to a picture that would be used to share with other people about war. Now, let me make sure there's one thing that you understand. Italy back then was not the Italy of today. Italy of today is a unified country, much like the United States. Back in his day, Italy was composed of city-states, little principalities, ruled by a ruling person, be it a king or monarch or whatever, even clergy. And they had these little, like, feastum, feistums, whatever, kingdoms that all across Italy. You know Rome. It was a principality. You know Pisa, the Leaning Tower of Pisa. It was a separate principality. Modena, Venice, Florence, all of these probably great cities that you know about in your travels to Europe or your study of Europe were at one time separate little principalities. And, oh, think of it like this. The Game of Thrones. Have you watched that on HBO? There are 12 kind of like kingdoms, and they are all in conspiracy to eventually become the king that sits on the Iron Throne, who will then be the king of all 12 separate kingdoms. That was Italy back then. And what Machiavelli learned through his experience is that Italy needed to be like France, unified under one leadership, and that was best for the country, that was best for the people. Back to what I talked about earlier in terms of Adam Smith and Karl Marx having their vision. Their vision gave rise to their mission. The mission gives rise to your goals. Goals give rise to your strategy. And all of that was fashioned from this idea of the best world possible, the world that the people's well-being would be taken care of and the rulers would be taken care of. That utopian kind of thing. So he, just like Karl Marx and just like our other guy, Adam Smith, he had this vision too of, wow, if we could only just unite all of the principalities under one leadership. That was what caused him, along with his observations of the various wars, the struggles, the conflicts that he was a part of, that he witnessed as his role and as a government servant, and then had a little power in one of the positions that he had where he actually was responsible for defending the little principality that he was an administrator for, very much like the Game of Thrones. Now I think about it, matter of fact, I'd go even further. I wouldn't be surprised if the Game of Thrones was not based upon Machiavelli. I don't know what I'm talking about, but anyway. So, given all of this, one important thing, too. He had risen to good position of power and influence within the government or the principality in which he lived. That principality was overthrown. He was basically a casualty of that. He was eventually put in jail. And when he got out of jail, he wanted to regain his power, his influence. And he wrote several books. And The Prince was probably, the last one that he wrote. And he wrote The Prince to give to the powers to be in his principality. He wanted to win favor. And what he did was he took and he tried to distill all of his years of experience and put it down on paper and give to the new prince. They didn't call him king then, the new prince, to show, if you want to stay in power, and if you want to increase your power, these are the things that I believe you must do. Not just you, any other prince would be wise to consider these principles and use them accordingly. So, this is what we're talking about, these principles that he came up with. And here's something very unique about the principles. They're not theoretical, abstract. They are principles derived from his actual experience as almost a historian and the many travels and the many jobs that he had, the viewpoints that he was able to view things from over decades. He distilled those down to principle. And what is unique about the Prince that give rise to Machiavellian being associated with something negative was that one of his first principles was that one needs to separate war from politics. And In doing so, one needs to abandon notions of morality, basically, good and evil. That you need to separate those two, three, and go out and win the war. And I don't know if he was the very first person to ever say this, but basically, by any means necessary. There is a quote that uses that phrase, but not exactly those words in that order, but that's what he was talking about. You go out, you win the war, and you do it any damn way you have to win. Don't politicize it. Don't moralize it. Just go out and win. It's much like there was a famous owner of a football team, pro football team, Al Davis, the Raiders. And his thing was, just win, baby. Just win. So that is where I think the Machiavellian label gets its negative connotation from, is that first principle, and then the rest of the principle as well. Other principles that, oh, and here's something too. I should have said this earlier. I'm sorry. When I talk about Italy and its city-states, I want you to think about the United States and its 50 separate states. Think of each state as a principality, its own rulers, sets of rules, its own social organization. And think about this. If you are Eli Broad, if you are Walton, if you are Bill Gates, individually, or if you are a group, and you want to take over public education, you have to take over public education from 50 separate principalities. How many school districts are there? Something like, is it 15,000 different school districts with 52 million students? And each of the school districts have school boards. Well, now they have mayoral control, but most school boards. How are you going to accomplish this? Think about one other thing that we talked about, how I marvel over the fact that the neoliberals were able to reach hegemony across the United States and almost the world in 30 to 35 years. That was lightning speed in terms of historical time. So I'm suggesting that the war itself was not an accident, wasn't an afterthought, that it was planned, and the plan, the agenda was, the end of the day, was to destroy public education and erect the privatization of public education, from education for the public good to education for the private good. And that what we see now is how the powers that be have gone about trying to separate each of the principalities, conquer, then unite them, with the goal of having a united principalities at the end of the rainbow, not only just here in the United States, but also globally. And as I had said earlier, you got to realize that education here in the U.S., we spend about anywhere from $1.2 to $1.5 trillion a year when you throw in pre-K to PhD. So think about that when I'm talking about Machiavelli and his observation and then the principles that he developed from his observation. Back to the fact that another principle, and I sort of like kind of almost want to laugh at this one, was that evilness was more than acceptable as a weapon of war. Listen to what I just said. Evilness was more than acceptable. A good prince, and the prince is the leader, the king, or what have you, acquires, using evil to help acquire other principalities, other land, other power, other resources. And he was saying that if you don't use evil, well, to use evil, you use evil for the purpose of acquiring another principality or expanding the reach of your own principality. You don't use evil to be evil, around torching people, killing people, etc., but you use it as a weapon that has a definite purpose. And I'm going to cheat a little bit here and apply this, give you a visual to sort of like think about. How about thinking of Rahm Emanuel as a prince? Does that conjure up an image of evil for you? He has the reputation as being cutthroat, dangerous, no holds barred, no sense of morality, everything goes to get his way or to get the job done. Think about Scott Walker, his next-door neighbor over in Wisconsin. On the East Coast, you guys, think about Cuomo as a prince. I'm just saying, just throwing it out there. Another principle that is very, very applicable here is you do everything that you have to do for power. It all comes down to power. How to get power, how to keep it. And he also talked about how to lose it. Land is power. Money is power. The people that you, when you conquer another municipality or principality, you conquer the people there as well. And so it comes down to power. He's offering lessons to a person in terms of, if you have power, this is how you keep it. This is how you expand it. If you don't have power and you want power, this is how you get it. I've seen people who didn't have power, they wanted power, and this is how those who were able to gain power did it. Those who tried and didn't, this is why they didn't. They didn't get the power. And so that you, Prince, must understand, and I underscore that word, because what he was trying to do is basically what we tried to do here on War Report. Make you aware, make you understand, have an emotional engagement with that which you now are aware of and understand. And then use those three in formulating your action. This isn't anything new. I'm sure many of you, and especially the teachers who are listening or who will come to the archives, you've seen this. If you've been teaching for the last 15 years, and for sure if you've been teaching the last 20, 25 years, you've seen the various reform movements come and go, although I don't call today's movement a reform movement whatsoever. I don't give it that quality and character. And you've seen how principals, superintendents have come and gone, board members, etc. Parents, you've seen the same thing in terms of who comes in. They come in with their plan, their agenda, how they go about trying to implement it, which brings me to another principal. He says that once you have power, it is better for you to be disliked than to be liked. It is better for you to be feared than to be praised. Because people, he had observed, fear motivate people to try and avoid pain. And if you are in a position to use your power to inflict pain, then people will fear you, may even respect you, but most likely they will obey you and not challenge you. So if you're going to be a prince seeking power or attempting to maintain power or expand your power, don't be a good guy. Don't be a guy that you want everyone to like. Instead, be a guy that everyone fears. And I'll go back to Rahm Emanuel. His reputation in Washington was that he was an evil son of a bitch. Dirty son of a bitch. Karl Rove. You did not want to get on this guy's shit list. He was Machiavelli all the way. Okay? Again, we're talking about principles. And think of it again as Mac giving advice to power people for the purpose of trying to incur favors that will get him back in his position of influence that he had but lost. So he has an agenda too here. But also, and this is crucial again, unlike the philosophers of his day, Mac was the first, is credited as being the first almost scholar of political warfare. He's credited for being a historian who used personal observation experience as evidence of what he's saying is true, as opposed to theoretical conjecture. That's important because today people go to books, go to wherever they can, and they study Machiavellian principles. And if you're not aware of it, you go to Amazon, any of the bookstore sites, go to Google, and you'll see where people have taken Machiavellian principles and applied it to their professions, like law, business. Now, education, manufacturing, a whole host of areas where his principles have been put in play. 500 years after his death. And I can say the same thing, too, about when we get to The Art of War by Sun Tzu. His principles are, 2,500 years old now? But they're just as relevant today as they were when he first developed them and shared them with his countrymen. Same thing with Mac. So what I'm trying to do is not give you a whole laundry list of all the principles, because we would be here 3 or 4 hours at least going just through Mac's whole list of principles. I'm giving you the ones that were, I would say, the tent poles of his overall set of theories, ideas, concepts about power, how to get it, how to keep it, how to grow it. And I'm trying to pick those principles that I believe, when we take a very close look at the situation today in education, we can begin to see for ourselves some individuals who are acting very much Machiavellian in their behavior, be it fellow teachers, be it principals, be it board members, be it the superintendent, be it community people. You will see, and particularly, I also want you to thank Randy Weingartner and Ms. Garcia in terms of how some of these principles that I'm talking about may apply to some of the people that I just mentioned. I'm just saying. Okay, so what have we got here? We have a situation where a man develops a set of observations, develops a set of principles. The most distinguishing part of his principles is the lack of morality and ethical rules. I said it earlier, but now I want to formalize it and say it again, that the most distinguishing characteristic of his principles was that he said you have to separate ideas of morality and ethics from your pursuit of power, your keeping it, and expanding it. That was so against the conventional wisdom of the time, when there were formal rules of conduct. Think of this. We, being the world, have what is known as the Geneva Conventions. World leaders got together and came up with a set of rules of conduct for war, based upon a code of morality, code of ethics, and that this is how you are to conduct yourself on the battlefield. You don't shoot unarmed people. You don't shoot civilians. When you capture a soldier, you imprison that soldier. You don't torture. You provide food, medical, and all the things that one needs to sustain life. And you certainly don't go around executing your prisoners when they're in your custody. Those have been rules that have been around for centuries. Max said, the hell with that. you do what you have to do to maintain or to get to grow your power. I'm saying the same thing over and over again. I want you to take, if nothing else, that principle and understand it, and then look at your situation, look at the situation that you were in if you were no longer teaching, and see if anything pops out in your memory about what you experienced that would fall under these principles. I bet you, you'll come up with something. We're going to upload the prints on our site for people to read. You know, it's free. So you can go through and see the principles yourself and study them. There are, I'd say, tons of books out there on the prints, analysis of the prints, running from Spark Notes to Cliff Notes to all kinds of things. But and if you decide to go that route, and I encourage you to do so with what I had said earlier in mind and applying it to the United States in terms of our 50 states, and states are responsible for education. So you've got 50 different states. And think of it, too, in terms of if you are a test maker, if you are a book publisher, textbook publisher, you have to go to 15,000 different school boards, school districts to try and sell your product versus what happened if you had just one big, huge territory that comprised the 50 different principalities. Think Common Core. Think the high state testing from Pearson, PAR, and Smart Balance. All of what I'm talking about, I think, is directly applicable to our current situation. And if you understand and able to use your understanding of, well, being aware of and then understanding and being able to use your awareness and understanding these principles, you will definitely come away with a much better idea of what has happened to you, what has happened to your profession, what has happened to your school, what has happened to public education. And I think it is that level of understanding that will help you engage in the type of conduct that would have the best chance of protecting, preserving, and defeating, well, protecting, preserving public education and defeating the effort to privatize education. This is difficult because there's so much here. I mean, there are dozens of principles. And I didn't even get to Sun Tzu, and his art of war. But be mindful of this. Mac laid out a policy, a set of policies. Sun Tzu, the Chinese general extraordinaire, he lays out a manual of how to operationalize, how to put into a process of getting it done. So like the yin and yang sort of concept. On the one hand, you got Mac laying out the conceptual framework and Sun Tzu laying out, this is how you get it done. This is how you wage war. This is how you win war. These are the things you need to know and do to be successful. And I'll just jump ahead just a little bit on Sun Tzu and think about this. I think his number one principle is you never start a war that you can't win. You never start a war that you can't win. Going back to my study and my coming to this position that I hold now, is I looked at the war and the people who started the war, who are prosecuting this war, and I said, they started this war with the full assurance that they were going to win it. You never start a war, at least if you're halfway sane, you never start a war that you can't win or it's questionable. Never. Your generals, your officers, your people on the front line, they have to believe that their leaders know what they're doing and that what they're doing is going to accomplish the mission. Like when Bush stood on the deck of that aircraft carrier and said, mission accomplished. Now, okay, boy, I've gone a long time. I didn't get all of the things that I wanted to do. There will be another part next week, and let me say something about that. I said to you last week that, you know, I'm going to the East Coast, and I'm going to do the TED Talks, but I'm also going to start doing research, documenting the people's stories and experience of the war from our point of view, stories that you will never get on mainstream corporate media, and that is going to be a Herculean task. I don't know if I can do both the weekly show and do the work that I'm out there to do, and I'm maybe gone as much as 8 weeks on this first leg of what would possibly be 30, 35 to possibly 40 weeks in duration. I'm trying to get all this done so that the findings can be made known to the public, with the idea that, as people have said, if the public only knew the real story, the public would be outraged. I want to get this story out, the people's story out, in time to let the public know about the war, how it's being fought, the effects, the consequences on people, put faces on the people, children, as students, the parents, the teachers, the schools themselves, the destruction that they've all experienced. That's a lot. And at this point, I'm going to be the only person out there. I'm going to be off my entire crew and et cetera. So it's questionable as to what I can continue to do as relates to the war report. I've gone over several options of inviting guest hosts in for different weeks. I've considered trying to do shows each Sunday from wherever I am and then give you updates as to what is happening in that given location, that state, that city, that district. I've considered bringing guest host in again, and I come on the last 10 or 15 minutes to give a weekly update. I've looked at all kinds of options, and I've decided that this is my baby. I do not want to not do the show on a weekly basis. I'm going to go out and try and see what I learned the first 3 weeks of October up to and after my first TED Talks I'm giving to, and the start of collecting the documentation for this whole project, and see whether or not I can do the show in addition to all the other stuff that I'm doing. So for this month, the show will go on. And for most of this month, I will be here doing it. So, time's up. Come back next week, and I will try and get Sung Su in and bring all of this back to the neoliberalism and the war that we're experiencing. Have a good Sunday, everyone. See you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.